Well, do keep that passage open. What would you say is the setting or the backdrop for the nativity story? Well-lit, unusually clean stable, maybe? Or the little town of Bethlehem, thronging with people as everyone returns to their birthplace for the census? Or maybe a complicated domestic situation with a woman who's betrothed to be married, and yet suddenly she tells her fiancé that she's pregnant. Lots of different backdrops. But Isaiah here gives us another perspective. He zooms right out, and he summarizes the backdrop to Christmas for us in one word. Can you spot it? Darkness. It's there in verse 2 of chapter 9. The people walking in darkness. If we allow Isaiah more words, well, we find these phrases: deep darkness, utter darkness, distress and darkness and fearful gloom. And often we associate Christmas with warm, fuzzy feelings. But what feelings does this description of deep, foreboding darkness conjure up for you? Where does your mind run with those images? Well, so says Isaiah, that is the backdrop to these familiar words in chapter 9. They're heard often in carol services, aren't they? That is the backdrop to the Christmas story, the event of great joy and angelic singing, darkness. And Isaiah is going to help us see this morning that we will only truly grasp the joy of Christmas if we first plumb the depths of the darkness. To do that, we need to step back again into the world in which Isaiah was living. We've been in Isaiah for the last few weeks. Step back into the world of 8th century BC. It was a bad time to be an Israelite. Long gone were the days when Israel was prosperous. And now the nations were flocking to Israel, but they were flocking there to fight them and to conquer them. Judah, as Isaiah speaks, on the horizon is the great nation of Assyria. And Assyria are a scary nation. And they're coming to try and conquer Israel. Just flick back to chapter 5 and verse 27, where we get a description of Assyria and what they are like. This is what it says in chapter 5, verse 27, about the Assyrian army. Not one of them grows tired or stumbles, not one slumbers or sleeps. Not a belt is loosened at the waist, not a sandal strap is broken. Their arrows are sharp, all their bows are strung. Their horses' hooves seem like flint, their chariot wheels like a whirlwind. Their roar is like that of the lion, they roar like young lions. They growl as they seize their prey and carry it off with no one to rescue. That is terrifying, isn't it? Description. The inhabitants of Jerusalem, I guess they would have gone to bed each night petrified about what terrors might befall them. A time of deep, distressing darkness. And yet that was just the start of their problems. As we've seen here in the last few weeks, in the early chapters of Isaiah, well, we've seen time and time again that the darkness that is enshrouding this people is much deeper than simply having this enemy marching towards them. Actually, at length, God has spoken of the darkness found within his people's hearts. Now, they're living for themselves. They're disregarding their neighbor unless it suits them. Isaiah said they call good evil and evil good. They acquit the guilty for a bribe and deprive the innocent of his rights. Now, the land's full of idols, and they bow down to the work of their own hands. And through all this, they show exactly what they think of God. They're not really bothered. You see, the darkness of which Isaiah speaks here, well, it's also found within the people's hearts. And then here's the surprise of these chapters. It turns out the darkness in their hearts and this terrifying enemy is marching towards them. Well, actually, those two things are connected. Because this enemy that's coming towards them actually isn't just a great superpower looking to take advantage of a weaker nation. In this situation, we learn that actually they are bringing God's judgment. Now, that's pretty hard to believe, that God would bring this awful enemy on his people. But just, if you're still back in chapter 5, let me just pick it up slightly earlier. So we had that description of Assyria and what they're like. And now listen to this from verse 24, halfway through verse 24. For they, God's people, have rejected the law of the Lord Almighty and spurned the word of the Holy One. Therefore, the Lord's anger burns against his people. His hand is raised and he strikes them down. The mountains shake and the dead bodies are like refuse in the streets. Yet for all this, his anger is not turned away. His hand is still upraised. He lifts up a banner for the distant nations. He whistles for those at the ends of the earth. Here they come, swiftly and speedily. Not one of them grows tired or stumbles. And so we get this description. It must be pretty hard for the people to imagine their situation could get worse than this great enemy coming against them. And yet it was, because they're told here that God is bringing Assyria to bring his holy, righteous judgment. Well, what a backdrop to the Christmas story. A broken world that's in turmoil. People rejecting God and facing the devastating consequences of that. Deep, thick, distressing darkness. And of course, we mustn't make the mistake of consigning these events entirely to the history books. This is a particular army coming at a particular time. Thankfully, Assyria is no longer on the scene. Actually, God judged them for their evil. And yet, its description of darkness is just as relevant today. Our world is still in turmoil because humanity has turned its back on God. Our world is still facing judgment for God because of that. A judgment to fall on a final day of judgment. And so now, with that backdrop in place, come to these familiar words from this famous Christmas reading in chapter 9. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of deep darkness, a light has dawned. Notice who this light shines on. It shines on those very people who have sinned against God, who are under his judgment. Before they've come to their senses, before they've repented, well, on them, most undeserving, this light shines. Pure grace. Verse 3 goes on, you've enlarged the nation and increased their joy. They rejoice before you as people rejoice at the harvest. What a transformation from a people who are clearly on the losing side, about to be crushed, to those who emerge victorious. From a people who were full of fear, rightly, to a people who are jubilant with joy. What is the cause of this joy? Well, read on again. For as in the day of Midian's defeat, you have shattered the yoke that burdens them, the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor. Every warrior's boot used in battle, every garment rolled in blood will be destined for burning, will be fuel for the fire. It's a wonderful image, isn't it? One of peace and an end to warfare that people love to cling on to at Christmas time. It's the desire that led to the Christmas Day truce in the trenches in World War I and the Band-Aid hit singles, Feed the World, Let Them Know It's Christmas Time. And we love to connect Christmas with peace and healing. And in one sense, all those things are caught up in the imagery here. This is a picture of a broken world being fixed. But knowing the backdrop of Isaiah, well, that helps us see that this is actually getting to one thing in particular. Because as those original hearers hear these verses, what is the army that is dominating their thoughts as they hear these verses? Well, it's the Assyrian army. It's the army that is coming, bringing God's judgment. But now, out of nowhere, they're told that this army will be brought to nothing. It's truly miraculous. When this light comes into the world, God's judgment is no longer going to be an issue for his people. Suddenly, emphatically, decisively, the sentence of judgment will be removed from them. That's why they're so jubilant. But of course, all that's not easy to achieve. We've seen that in the last few weeks, the depth of the problem. And so imagine a faithful Israelite living in that darkness, aware of their own failings. What is going to help them believe and trust this promise? Or what about a faithful All Saints member living amongst darkness, aware of your failings? What is going to help you believe and trust this promise? Well, it turns out the what is a who. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given. The focus of our hope is a person, a child, Jesus. And not just born, but given to us in our moment of greatest need. Fear to joy, darkness to light. And actually, as an object of our hope, this child is pretty impressive. And people care about what's on your CV, don't they? The more qualifications you've got, the longer your job description on LinkedIn, well, the better. And so if you were due to appear in court before Baron Bernard of Maldon, Privy Councillor, Lord Chief Justice of England and Wales, well, I think you'd be pretty confident that you could trust that you would be treated justly. Or how about Olympic gold medalist, WBA, IBF, WBO, IBO, unified world heavyweight champion Anthony Joshua? Well, that is a good man to have fighting in your corner. Titles, you see, they help us understand why we should place our hopes and our trust in this particular person. Well, look at the titles that this child has. Wonderful Counselor. What are people who are unable to trust the wisdom of their own hearts or the guidance of their own leaders need? Well, they need someone whose perspective is untainted by the darkness in the world. They need someone who in his very being is the fountain of all knowledge and who offers that good counsel to anyone who will listen. Mighty God. Well, what do a people who are at the mercy of their enemies and the mercy of their own hearts need? Need someone who comes with the full authority of God, who has got the power to turn even the deepest darkness into the brightest light, to make the impossible possible. Everlasting Father. Now, this might seem like an odd name at first, because we've already been told he's the Son. And we know, don't we, that you've got God the Father and you've got God the Son, and they are different persons within the Trinity. And so Isaiah got a little bit confused, like we all do, about the Trinity here. Well, I don't think so. I think here, as he describes Jesus as Everlasting Father, he's not talking about his relationship with his own Father, but rather he's talking about the relationship he will have with those who come under his rule. And he might be a mighty God, but he also has the compassion and the care and the intentional love of a father. And he'll always be like that. He'll never grow old. I love being a father. I love caring for Avani, my daughter, stopping her from all her ingenious schemes to injure herself. But one day, and she doesn't know this yet, but the roles are going to be reversed. Because I'll be old and senile, and she'll be looking after me, stopping me from all my ingenious schemes to injure myself. I don't really like to think about it, but my ability to be a protective father has got a timescale on it. But for those who welcome his coming, Jesus will be an everlasting father, never weakening in his care for us, always there, seeking our best. Prince of Peace. We've already said many people desire peace, rightly so, but actually don't have a great idea about how to actually obtain it beyond a momentary pause in the trenches or releasing a charity single. And also, many people don't understand the degree to which we need peace, not just peace amongst humanity, but also, most importantly, peace with God. And yet, when Jesus was born, the wise, mighty, compassionate one, well, he came on a peace mission. That's what he's all about, to deal with the condemnation that hangs over us. Isaiah doesn't tell us how he does it at this stage. He simply puts judgment and salvation side by side in something of a paradox and says, trust this child, he'll sort it out. But later, in familiar words to some of us, Isaiah again picks up the language of peace, and he says this about Jesus. He says, upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. And with his wounds on the cross, we are healed. You see, peace with God is not easy to accomplish. But through this Son who was given to us, as he died on the cross, he took that punishment. And it's like that army of judgment that was marching towards us, about to overwhelm us, well, is suddenly flattened, stopped in its tracks, just like that. Judgment earned, salvation meeting at the cross. And whilst we need to be clear that peace with God must come first, well, the peacemaking doesn't end there. The removal of condemnation is like a pair of floodgates that sprung open, and peace flows out in all directions. We see that in verse 7, the wise, mighty, compassionate peacemaker, well, he won't stop until light has been shone into every dark crevice. Now, Jesus' reign, we're told, would be one of righteousness, transforming the hearts of those who come to him so they no longer produce only darkness, but also light. Through this, bring about communities where oppression and greed and selfishness are no longer the norm. Now, that's what the church is supposed to be. And one day, making this whole world new again, so that no war or injustice or suffering remains. A world of light without any darkness. Do you see, this tells us that Jesus provides all the things that we long for, which the world longs for, but provides them in a lasting way. Because he knows where the deepest problem lies, and he's come to deal with that. And we began with the sobering observation that the backdrop to the Christmas story is one of darkness, but actually it's also a backdrop of repeated promises, that God has got a plan to sort it all out, that he is going to put his king on the throne. And we stand today the other side of that king's arrival, preparing to celebrate Jesus' birth rather than, like the first hearers, wait in hope for it. We're able to look back and see so many promises that have been fulfilled. And so what an opportunity this Christmas time to proclaim afresh this hope-filled message of light and hope and peace to a world that's plagued by darkness. And also, what an opportunity to proclaim that same message to one another. Because we'll all have different circumstances, but each of us will struggle with sin. And that will mean many of us also struggle with assurance. Is God really for me? Am I really forgiven? Well, yes, by giving us his Son, God has made sure that's the case. And many here I know carrying all sorts of other burdens, illness or grief or depression or financial struggles. So often part and parcel of life in this broken, dark world. Well, if you're a follower of the Lord Jesus, you can be absolutely sure that those things are not signs that God's face is set against you. And you can rest in sure hope that one day they'll be gone forever. And in the meantime, well, I love the picture we get in chapter 8, verse 16. There's this little faithful remnant in Judah, Isaiah and some others, and they're engulfed by so much darkness, and what do? Well, they gather around God's testimony, around his promises. They commit to waiting for him to complete what he started. Because of what he promises them, they say, we are going to trust him. And when other people tell them to look elsewhere for comfort or hope, well, they're resolute and they cling even closer to his promises. And so let's hear the encouragement to do that ourselves. To be honest about the reality of darkness, how that plays out in our lives, and yet encourage each other to see that darkness is no longer the dominant theme. And to cling above all to this testimony about this child who is our supernatural counselor, mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Let's pray.